The headlines: the U.S. Capitol goes under heavy security days ahead of the presidential inauguration after a deadly attack on Congress by Trump supporters. Turkey says it will be very problematic for Ankara to turn back on its purchase of Russian S-400 defense systems. And South Korea's top court upholds a 20-year jail term for former President Park Geun-hye on graft charges that led to her downfall. Hello and welcome, everybody. Authorities in the U.S. are beefing up security in the capital, Washington, D.C., ahead of the January 20th inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will remain on high alert in the city. The Pentagon earlier announced that these forces were also authorized to carry weapons and make arrests, citing public safety as their priority. A number of public areas and monuments will also be closed to the public until after the inauguration. The security measures come amid fears of violent protests during that ceremony. Last week, the Congress building was breached by supporters of President Donald Trump, and five people were killed. As a result, the House of Representatives has already impeached Trump over charges of inciting insurrection on the Capitol. Author and journalist Daniel Lazar says the second impeachment of Donald Trump shows the United States is experiencing a deepening structural crisis.
The U.S. is entering into a period of growing instability for a variety of reasons. COVID-19 is out of control. Nearly 400,000 people have died. The American empire is in crisis. It's grossly overextended. 22 million jobs have disappeared since the lockdown. A massive housing crisis is looming. And now the political system itself, a 233-year-old political system, which has never been thoroughly revised, is now collapsing before our very eyes. And that's what this is about. This is about a deepening structural crisis where the two branches are at each other's throat. The parties are far apart. There's no opportunities for resolution. Things can only get worse and worse.
The Turkish defense minister says Ankara will not turn back on its deal for Russian S-400 missile systems despite opposition from the U.S. Hulusi Akar said annulling the contract on the S-400 import would be, quote, very problematic. However, he expressed hope that a dispute with the U.S. on the issue could be resolved through dialogue. He called on Washington to distance itself from threatening language such as sanctions. Washington slapped sanctions on Turkey last month following its acquisition of the S-400s. The U.S. says the Russian missile systems pose a threat to its F-35 fighter jets and to NATO's broader defense systems. Turkey rejects the accusations and says S-400s will not be integrated into NATO. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Rashan Saglam, who's joining us from Istanbul. Also, we have political observer Hatem Yav, who's also with us from Istanbul. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Rashan. Please walk us through the recent comments made by the Turkish defense minister regarding the S-400 missile defense system.
Yes, actually, Hulusi Akar spoke about the S-400 because the S-400 missiles are actually being implemented for real this time in Turkey, and the work with those missiles will start. Turkey said that the missiles will be put in places where Turkey thinks it is necessary to protect its soil and its air, of course. And Hulusi Akar also mentioned that we have been calling the United States to work with us on this issue. However, instead of negotiations and sitting on the table and instead of dialogue, they use the language of sanctions, which does not work between allies. Allies should not be using this language between each other, especially the Turkey and the United States are not only NATO allies, they have been allies for several decades now. The countries have a lot of common issues and common working together on regional issues, working together on international issues. So this is actually weird, and this is actually not acceptable for Turkey to get sanctions from its own allies. And also, Lucy Carr mentioned that we have been asking the United States to work on us after purchasing the S-400, because they were claiming that it may be a threat on the F-35. He said that there is no threat from those missiles on the fighter jets, the F-35. However, we still insisted that the United States would send a delegation to work with us and the Russians on this. However, the United States did not respond to our request. And also, let me here mention, it's a little bit of a history recap. Turkey, when Turkey needed an air defense, it resorted to its own ally, the United States, asking for Patriot missiles. However, at the when the Obama administration was in office, it refused, and it was stalling the answers, or to give answers, acceptance to the Turkish request. And also, with the Trump administration coming, Turkey and the United States had a lot of disagreements, one of which is the Syrian crisis, one of which is how to protect Turkish borders, as well as the YPG and PYD being supported by Turkey's ally, the United States. And we all know that those militants are the enemy of Turkey inside Syria. So this whole thing and the stalling of the Patriot led Turkey to resort to Russia to buy the S-400 missiles, as it is mainly the same system or a similar system to the Patriot missiles. So it all started when the United States did not respond to its own allies' request to get the air defense. And Turkey had said before that we needed an air defense under the circumstances that the region is going through, with the situation in Iraq, the crisis in Syria, and everything happening in the region. Also, the attacks coming from the Kurdistan Workers' Party from Iraq or Syria and its affiliated groups, we needed to secure our borders and our air. So we needed those missiles, and our allies did not respond to our needs. We had to resort to Russia, and actually this was beneficial for Russia. Russia needed to have an ally like Turkey in the region, and because of the United States stances, this actually happened.
Thank you, Rashan. Let's cross over to Hatem Yavuz. Hatem, I'd like to get your thoughts on what was just said by Rashan. Do you think that it's the U.S.'s fault in the first place that Turkey has turned to Russia for the S-400 defense system?
Rashan is actually very correct on what she said. Let me just elaborate on top of that. It's been over a decade where Turkey has been requesting for air defense systems from its so-called NATO ally, United States, where they would, and it wasn't a donation, it was a purchase to pay for those systems, like they paid for the F-35s, which Turkey got kicked out of. Now, if you look at this hypocrisy of allies, Turkey realized that it's alone in this region, and it had to seek out other systems around the globe, such as China in 2016, where they were under pressure by the United States and its NATO allies not to purchase the Chinese air defense systems. So therefore, Turkey resorted to a very advanced S-400. Now, why is the West, especially the United States, fearing that Turkey, its main second largest NATO ally, using an S-400 system? Because it captures even the F-35s in the air. So it's basically capturing its own allies up in the air. Now, why has Turkey taken this stance? Well, it's because of Obama and Trump regime. And it's not the leadership, it's the system. You know, it's the deep state. So you look at it into a perspective, and Turkey had to weigh its balance and said, hey, if the Americans are going to give out thousands of truckloads of armory to their allies' enemy, which is the YPG, PKK, whatever you want to call those alphabets, what's going to happen in the next few years if they attack us? So if we used an American system now, today, it won't probably work on Turkish on the Turkish soil. So for that reason, Turkey had to be more independent and receive information technology transfer from the Russians under the S-400 program. So it's not just the machinery itself of the $2.4 billion purchase, it's the technology transfer, which means Turkey's independent technology, as you probably know from its wars, its backing of the wars in Libya, using their drones and their anti-blocking radar systems in Azerbaijan and so on, and Nagorno-Karabakh. Turkey has been staunch to develop its own systems integrated to with its S-400 together, not a NATO ally system. And this will go on. This will go on for the next term of presidency of Biden, arguing don't set up the S-400s. Well, Turkey has set up the S-400s. Like it or not, Turkey has to take and control its own security and its own interest.
So basically what you're saying, Mr. Yavuz, is as the Turkish defense minister, Mr. Akar, has expressed hope that a dispute with the U.S. on this issue could be resolved through dialogue. That's not a stance that the United States is willing to be taking.
Those sanctions, if you notice those sanctions, they're targeted sanctioning by the Katsa sanction, whatever the Americans love making, I call it American, the sanction country, the Katsa, sanctioning the defense industry, the defense ministry of Turkey, and its individuals or scientists or whatever they need as part of whatever they're sanctioning, individuals as well. So it's not against the S-400s. It's against Turkey's advancement in its own defense system. I mean, you probably saw it on the news. Our drone has become the icon of the world of new warfare. And some of those missiles that the Turks are making today, miniature missiles that they're making today, has been mind-blowing. So the Americans, or the U.S., are targeting not the S-400s. It's targeting the whole Turkish defense system. So what's going to happen after this, I believe?
All right, we lost that connection there, and also that's all the time we have for this segment. Thanks to our guest, Rashan Saglam, our correspondent, joining us from Istanbul. Also thanks to a political observer, Mr. Hatem Yavuz, joining us from Istanbul. That's it with this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. South Korea's apex court has upheld a 20-year prison term for former President Park Geun-hye over a corruption conviction. The ruling is final on an extended legal process, including a previous Supreme Court hearing. The court also upheld fines and forfeits totaling $19.5 million. Park Geun-hye was impeached in 2017 following massive protests against her. The following year, she was convicted of bribery and abuse of power and sentenced to 30 years in prison. Her sentence was later reduced to 20 years following her appeals and a retrial. The country's first female president has also separately been sentenced to 2 years in prison for election law violations. She now faces a total of 22 years behind bars. Jennifer Chang says Park Geun-hye's hardline policy on North Korea was one of the main reasons why South Koreans opposed her during her presidency.
Of course, the majority of South Koreans still oppose pardoning President Park. They still haven't forgiven her for all of her crimes, which ultimately led to her becoming the only South Korean president ever to be removed from office through the impeachment process back in 2017. Much of that had to do with not only her crimes, but also her hardline North Korea policy, which many South Koreans felt was going to bring on a possible second Korean War, which to South Koreans is unacceptable. President Park, when she was president, she was willing to actually conduct a preemptive strike militarily on North Korea if it was thought that the North would attack the South. So she had a variety of reasons why the South Korean public opposes her.
A team of international scientists led by the World Health Organization has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to begin a probe into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Peter Ben Emberick, leader of the team, said they would initially focus on advancing several studies and site visits. He, however, added that the investigation would take a long time. The arrival of WHO experts coincides with China's announcement of its first COVID-related fatality in 8 months. The country has also recorded its highest daily cases in more than 5 months. China is grappling with a resurgence of the coronavirus amid strict lockdowns. A total of nearly 88,000 infections and over 4,600 related deaths have been reported there since the emergence of the virus in late 2019. Stephen Rabe says a WHO investigation into COVID-19 origins in China will be highly politicized.
The U.S. under Trump, for example, has blamed China for not being transparent enough at the beginning of this pandemic and not doing enough to warn the rest of the world, which is a bit rich coming from Trump, who downplayed the threat right at the beginning. Of course, it's disappointing. This mission has been a long time coming. It was held up by China. And the WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has said he actually criticized China. He said he was disappointed that they weren't given clearance to arrive earlier. I think it's because China's scared of this blame game, that the whole thing is going to be used as an exercise to blame China. It must be stressed that blame is going to do no good whatsoever. Everybody is hoping that the WHO scientists will be able to interview, be able to research, and find out where this virus came from in order to save the world from a future epidemic. Maybe something which is much worse than this one.
The Iranian Navy is holding the second and final day of massive military exercises in the Sea of Oman. Iranian surface combat units, subsurface naval forces, as well as aerial units are practicing battles with Iraq enemy forces and are performing joint operations against any possible military scenario. Surface-to-surface cruise missiles and torpedoes will be fired from domestically developed submarines during the exercises. Unmanned aerial operations and electronic warfare tactics will be exercised as well. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparedness and military prowess of the country's armed forces in these strategic southern waters. Elsewhere, Iran has warned that the U.S. designation of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization will hamper peace efforts in the country. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the blacklisting will also undermine the delivery of humanitarian aid to Yemen. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the outgoing Donald Trump administration is seeking to finish off its destructive role in Yemen's war and bring the political solution and peace talks in the Arab country to a deadlock. He pointed to the U.S. financial and military support for the Saudi-led coalition, saying Washington is the main accomplice to the crimes in Yemen. The U.N. has also warned about the serious humanitarian and political repercussions of the blacklisting. The move will come into effect on January the 19th, the Trump administration's last full day in office. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masoud Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know? And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do. Nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it doesn't. It's not really a kind of comprehensive look at this situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk, and of course his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him, and he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. So it's, and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved. But some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masood, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way, because, you know, as the film was about the franchised sort of youth getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of, what it sort of tackled is that here, Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And, you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost. You
so
know.
You're saying there's multiple messages in this film.
It is, but I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages, and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story, because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken up there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them, and out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys got. And that is something...
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities
at home. I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of did not actually reach that... Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and have nothing to do, of the fact that, you know, I mean, they were saying that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing. You know,
that's
I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Al-Shabaab, look for vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are easy target for Al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and believing, you know, in his own mind, he doesn't trust the police, because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family, because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like him, he joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world, and they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this, and the reality is that they're forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. The elephant in the room is being ignored, and the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in a real sense for the right things, for the right reason, and for the with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of a solution. And I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, you know, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving message that end justifies the means. You know, and that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. You know, they're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's
story.
A merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, you know, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, you know, and I saw that it was wrong, endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, you know, being tricked into just endless killing, non-stop. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be... I don't know what he's done. Has he
but
done anything illegal?
In the film, does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Monsieur, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know, that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we've got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has had backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, it's backfiring now, it's backfiring in Syria. And out of that it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which is which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of their society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had. But then that's another film. So.
Mm-hmm. And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long and it raises many questions, but as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come up fairly strongly about immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام تمام الحج لقاء الإمام.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The pilgrimage is completed by meeting the Imam."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing and an honor to have you with us on the program. Now you're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find a very interesting dialogue, a golden conversation, if you will, between Jabir al-Jufi, who is one of the famous companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and he also happens to be one of the most knowledgeable students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now this conversation between the two is relatively long, but as we move forwards towards the end of this conversation, we find that the points become shorter, but the meanings become more profound. At one point, Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon this truly divinely appointed Imam with divine knowledge, says, "There is no power like the victory over caprice, and there is no injustice like following." So, dear friends, we find that here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam tells us a very beautiful piece of advice via his student Jabir al-Jufi. Imam al-Baqir says that there is no power like having the power to be victorious over one's fancies, over caprice, over one's whims. This is true victory, when we are stronger than what our lowly nafs, the self which commands us towards these instinctual carnal desires or worldly material wealth. When we overcome these whims of the nafs, of the self, then we are truly victorious. And likewise, Imam al-Baqir tells us that there is no injustice, greater than following, being subservient to, obeying such lowly fancies and whims and materialistic or bodily desires and caprice. Now, as we have always said, Islam is the religion of moderation. So material wealth in moderation, eating food in moderation, relations with our spouse in moderation, everything in moderation. This is Islam, the religion of perfection. And so, as Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has said so eloquently in this conversation, there is no power stronger than victory over caprice, and there is no injustice like following and being subservient to caprice. Beautiful words in this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Imam al-Baqir, lastly, one point he mentioned is very important for us to remember. He said, Allah ashaddu farahan بِتَوْبَةِ عَبْدِهِ مِنْ رَجُلٍ أَضَلَّ رَاحِلَتَهُ وَزَادَهُ فِي لَيْلَةٍ ظَلْمَاءَ فَوَجَدَهَا فَاللَّهُ تَعَالَى أَشَدُّ فَرْحًا لِتَوْبَةِ عَبْدِهِ مِنْ ذَلِكَ الرَّجُلِ بِرَاحِلَتِهِ حِينَ وَجَدَهَا. Imam alayhi salam says there is one thing we need to remind ourselves, that is about tawbah. He says, a person who does tawbah, you repent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah becomes so happy with you. And he gives a parable. He said, if you see someone who has lost his camel or horse plus food, he was on a journey and he lost the camel and the food, and he started searching for the camel and food, imagine when he finds the camel and the food, how happy this man will be in the middle of nowhere. He said, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is so happy, happier than the man who has found his camel and food in the middle of nowhere, and he becomes so happy. Allah will be more happier than this particular individual when you do tawbah. We shouldn't delay that. When we wrong ourselves, we need to go back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in order for us to do tawbah.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.